This archived broadcast of Janet Meffer Today is brought to you by TriStar Pictures' A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, based on the true story, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks and Matthew Rhys. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters now.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it!
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you so much for joining us again. In November 2018, you might remember a Chinese scientist revealed he had used a revolutionary gene editing tool called CRISPR to edit the genomes of two human embryos in the hopes of protecting the twin girls from HIV. Now, in recalling this shocking news, a biochemist who helped invent CRISPR technology recently said that the scientist's risky and medically unnecessary work stunned the world and defied prior calls by my colleagues and me and by the U.S. National Academies of Sciences of Medicine for an effective moratorium on human germline editing. And she added that it was a shocking reminder of the scientific and ethical challenges raised by this powerful technology. What led up to the medical scandal of the decade? Well, we're going to talk it over today with the genetic expert who was the first person in the world to publicly condemn this Chinese scientist's professional and ethical lapses, Dr. Kiran Musunuru. He is professor and genetics researcher at the University of Pennsylvania and also an actively practicing cardiologist and the recipient of many awards, including the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers from the White House. Today, we'll be discussing his book called The CRISPR Generation, The Story of the World's First Gene-Edited Babies. Dr. Musunuru, wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. This was a very big story. I recall this when this came out, and many people were very stunned by it. But a lot of people didn't know what this technology really was. In layman's terms, can you kind of explain for people what this gene editing tool really is?
Sure. So gene editing is a technology that allows us to make changes to genes in the DNA in the body. Now, typically, these genes are related to health and disease. There are several different types of gene editing tools, but by far the most popular one is the one called CRISPR. CRISPR and other gene editing tools can either be used to turn off genes, and that was the intent of the Chinese scientists' experiments with embryos that ultimately yielded live-born twins that you referred to, that happened last November. CRISPR can also potentially be used to make precise alterations to genes. You could imagine this being useful, for example, by correcting a mutation that causes disease.
Right.
Now, this turns out to be harder to do than simply turning off a gene.
Well, that makes sense, and that's very understandable. What are the ethical boundaries, though, around the use of this particular tool? Because, as I mentioned in the intro, you had been the first person to come out and really share concerns about what this Chinese scientist did. Why? What was the reason?
Yeah, so before I address that directly, I should point out that there are two very different scenarios where gene editing can be used. It could be used for adult patients. These are people who are suffering from disease. Mm-hmm. These are also people who can freely consent to the medical procedure that involves the gene editing. They can weigh the benefits and the risks, and they can make an informed decision as to whether they want to receive the therapy and potentially be exposed to the risks, and decide whether the benefits greatly outweigh the risks. The other situation, the scenario that happened with the Chinese scientist last year, that's a very different scenario where the editing was done in embryos, in human embryos, that were then used to establish pregnancy and resulted in the birth of twin girls. Now, those girls clearly did not have the opportunity to consent to what was done with them long before they were born. And the other distinction between editing in adult patients who have an active disease and receive the gene editing and it's targeted to the organ that's suffering from the disease or causing the disease, such as the blood or the liver or the heart, when you're talking about an embryo, that embryo becomes the entire person's body after pregnancy.
Right.
And so any edits that are made in the embryo end up in the entire body of the child that ultimately becomes a person, an adult, hopefully, if they remain healthy. And what that means is that that person's egg cells or sperm cells, also contain the edits. And so if that person were to have children, there's the possibility of passing on those edits to the next generation and even the next generation after that and so forth. So you're not just talking about one person, you're talking about future generations. And so there are important ethical implications of all of these future generations having no say whatsoever in what was done all the way back at the beginning in an embryo.
Well,
they're
now,
also, yeah, so go ahead.
Yeah, please. I was going to ask you, this Chinese scientist, by way of, you know, what I've read about this Chinese scientist, didn't have any medical training. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So he was trained as a physicist and then spent time doing research, doing graduate studies in what you would call biophysics. He didn't have any particular expertise in medicine. Certainly, he had no medical training. He was not a physician. He did not have any experience running clinical trials. And yet he took it upon himself to run a set of experiments under the guise, if you will, of a clinical trial to run experiments on unborn babies.
Wow, that's incredible. That is really incredible. Well, when you talk about the fact that adults obviously can consent in a way that embryos certainly cannot, one of the things that you mentioned was rightly that any sort of gene editing that takes place on an embryo would affect future generations if that baby grew up and became a parent himself or herself. Are there any known results that have been published about the effects, or is this kind of a big question mark as to what the effect would be on future generations from doing this?
It's an entirely open question. We have no idea since we've never been in this situation before. What we do know with these particular embryos that became twin girls from information that has not been published and probably will never be published, but was made available to me early on under confidential conditions before the news broke, so I had the chance to see it firsthand. What I can say is that everything that you worry about going wrong with gene editing with CRISPR did go wrong in these embryos. So there was not much control over what CRISPR did. It made some of the desired edits, but it also made additional edits that were unintended. So in genes other than the gene that this Chinese scientist was trying to, in this case, turn off. And there also was messiness in the sense that some cells got edits, other cells got different edits, some cells may have gotten no edits at all. And that ends up being reflected in the body of the human being who's born from the embryo. So we really have no idea what's going on in their bodies. They could have a mix of potentially beneficial edits, but also potentially harmful edits. And as we've already discussed, these edits, harmful, potentially with unknown consequences to health, could be passed on to future generations.
Goodness. Well, has there been any follow-through on these twin girls measuring the outcomes thus far in their bodies from these unintended edits that you've mentioned just now?
So it is unclear what has happened to these girls. Reportedly, they were born prematurely and were in the hospital for a while. Now, whether that was because of the editing that was done or whether that was just ordinary circumstances, many babies are born prematurely, of course,
sure,
is unknown, unclear. It may not be possible to know. The scientist in question and his team did not have access to the babies. The medical team taking care of the babies in the hospital actually had no idea that they'd been subjected to this experimentation, and security is tight, and the scientist had no way of getting at the baby. So they studied the placenta, they studied the umbilical cord, the organs that are discarded after birth, and they actually, in those organs, you can actually tell that there were problems with the gene editing. So it's almost certain that there are problems or genetic damage or however you want to frame it in the bodies of the kids themselves, but the scientists never had the opportunity to study them. The Chinese government has said publicly that they will provide medical care to the children. No comment on whether there will be any sort of analysis or assessment of what might be occurring in the kids' bodies. And of course, no news has been forthcoming from the Chinese government over the last year, and it's not clear whether there ever will be an update.
Good grief. Well, that's an ethical problem in and of itself, it would seem to me, because if the scientist had absolutely no, you know, doctor-patient relationship with these children because he wasn't a doctor, he's not a physician, then you sort of lose the accountability factor, don't you? If you're just doing it as a human experiment and you really don't have any sort of relationship whatsoever with the quote-unquote patients, then that would pose all sorts of problems, which leads to more questions, of course, we're going to pause very quickly, though, for a break. We'll come back to it with Dr. Kiran Musunuru. His book is called The CRISPR Generation, the story of the world's first gene-edited baby. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $249 for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Maybe I can just have my baby. It don't matter what nobody says.
This is the end of the story of a young mom who planned to end her pregnancy but chose life after visiting a preborn center. Preborn steps into the lives of hurting young women who are being told that a preborn baby is not a life. Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasounds in the country and the direct answer to Planned Parenthood, helping young moms choose life.
I feel like it was meant for me to have this baby. This is something God gave me for a reason.
You can be a part of choosing life with young hurting women across the country. Would you join with Preborn and Janet Mefford today to help save 400 babies by the end of 2019. For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies from abortion. And now, through a match, your gift of $140 will actually help save 10 babies instead of 5. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, dial 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today. Thank you for being with us. And we are talking with Dr. Kiran Musunuru about his book, The CRISPR Generation, the story of the world's first gene-edited babies. And Dr. is professor and genetics researcher at the University of Pennsylvania and the first person really to come out in the world to publicly condemn that Chinese scientist who did this experiment. This revolutionary gene editing tool called CRISPR was used to edit the genomes on these twin girls. And we all know about that case from a year ago. But certainly, Dr. Musunuru, this really raises ethical concerns, because this guy was not a doctor, as you mentioned, not a physician, and has not had follow-up with these girls because apparently he doesn't even know them. Is that in and of itself an ethical lapse?
That's a big problem. So when a study like this is ordinarily done, it's done very carefully with a lot of oversight. I mean, when we're talking about a clinical trial, there is so much work that goes into getting approval for the clinical trial. In the United States, it would come from the Food and Drug Administration. There's literally years of work that go into it. You have to submit an application with thousands of patients of documentation that what you're trying to do is reasonably safe and of potential benefit. It goes through a whole approval process. And then after that, there's whole levels of oversight to make sure that the work is being done properly. There was none of that in what this Chinese scientist did. So
wow.
That's a huge ethical problem. And then I would point out there are lots of other ethical problems. For example, it wasn't clear that the parents or the prospective parents in this trial, and there were something like 7 couples who were ultimately involved in this clinical trial with the one pregnancy we know about and possibly a second pregnancy whose outcome is unclear. These parents, it was not clear that they were in a position where they were free of coercion and free of undue influence. We very much worry about exploitation.
Right.
And in each of these couples, the father was HIV positive on medication to keep the viral load down, and so they were healthy. But the whole premise of this clinical trial was to protect the children from potential infection with HIV. Now, here's the problem. In China, HIV carries a lot of stigma, and if you are part of an HIV couple, you do not have access to fertility services. You can't undergo the procedure of in vitro fertilization and have babies if you're not naturally able to. Through this trial, the scientist offered these couples the only way that they could potentially have in vitro fertilization. And so that's a big, big red flag when you're recruiting people in this trial, offering them something extremely valuable, extremely desired that they otherwise would not have the opportunity to undergo. And, you know, it smacks of coercion and exploitation. That's another big ethical no-no.
Oh, absolutely. It's very disturbing. What were the scientific breakthroughs that led up to CRISPR? Because I know this is something else that you address in the book. What milestones were hit in order to get to this point in technology?
Sure. So in the case of HIV, there were really two big scientific advances. One was an understanding of the genetics that either makes people vulnerable or protects them from HIV infection, from the virus that causes AIDS. Almost 20 years, more like 25 years ago, it was understood that there were people who are naturally resistant to the virus. And genetic studies found that there was a particular gene, a gene called CCR5, that was naturally turned off in these people. Now, that's one aspect of things, understanding that this gene is involved in HIV infection, and if turned off, would make you resistant to it. The second aspect is the technology of gene editing, CRISPR, which really only arrived on the scene 6 years ago, 2013. And this gene editing potentially gives you the ability to turn off this CCR5 gene and make people resistant to HIV. Now, I should note that this has been used in clinical trials with adult patients who are HIV positive, taking some of their T cells, the cells that are infected by HIV, editing them so that they are now resistant to the virus and putting them back into the body. And it worked. The cells didn't last forever because the cells only have a limited lifetime, even in normal circumstances. But it was successful. And we're starting to see this CRISPR technology being applied to other diseases. Just yesterday morning, in fact, it was announced that two patients received a CRISPR-based therapy. Each of these patients had a severe blood disorder that causes great suffering. One is called sickle cell disease. The other is called beta thalassemia. And this treatment that was given to them earlier this year appears to have worked and might possibly have cured these patients.
Wow.
Which, if true, would be historic. These are devastating diseases that previously were incurable. And now we have a treatment with CRISPR that could potentially help hundreds of thousands of people around the world.
Yeah.
More is coming.
That's amazing. I read about that. That was one American and then one European patient, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Boy. Yeah. And that's the upside of having technology like this. When you have adults who can actually consent and you can actually break through and cure diseases potentially, then it's awesome. But how do you regulate this? Because even this bioethicist that I was referring to earlier, who invented CRISPR, was one of the people who invented CRISPR in the first place, had said, you know, the moratorium is good, but maybe isn't going to work. I mean, how in the world do you figure out in the medical community how to regulate CRISPR so you don't have abuses like with this Chinese scientist, especially when you're involving entities like the Chinese government?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is we don't have a good way to do it. It's a huge challenge. The World Health Organization on the one hand and the National Academy of Sciences and Medicine in the United States have independently convened committees or commissions looking at this issue. They've recruited people from all around the world, experts, people involved in genetics, people involved in medicine, bioethicists, and so forth, to really wrestle with these issues and solicit input from all types of constituencies, whether it's scientists or physicians or patient groups or ethicists and so forth, and really try to synthesize these into regulatory frameworks. Now, these groups have no legal power. So what they're going to have to do is propose these regulatory frameworks and the timeline, because this takes time, it's not going to happen until late next year, and then hope to persuade governments around the world to adopt these regulatory frameworks. Now, all of this is really voluntary. It's really up to governments of countries to decide that this is the best thing for their citizens and for anyone who happens to visit their country to potentially undergo a procedure like this. It's up to them whether or not they're going to adopt legislation and regulation to ensure that if this is done, it is done safely.
Yeah. Well, it is concerning. And I had mentioned before this biochemist, actually not bioethicist, but she also had mentioned the issue of the Pandora's box, which always is a question when it comes to medical ethics. What do you think about the issue of a Pandora's box being opened that can no longer be shut? You know, how do you look at this whole issue of using CRISPR in a way that will benefit people but not harm people? Because that, like you said, it would be up to the individual countries to put the parameters around how you could use it and so forth. But, you know, the idea of designer babies is still very creepy to a lot of people, and I think rightfully so.
Yes, exactly. I agree 100%. How do you accept the good and prevent the bad? And that's always the challenge with technology. So you can compare a technology like gene editing to fire. If it's used carefully, regulated well, it can do a lot of good. But if you're not careful with it, then it can get out of hand. It can spread. It can cause wildfires and cause a lot of damage. And that's exactly what we're dealing with CRISPR. You hope that regulations and legislation can curb people like this Chinese scientist, but it's very challenging because it really doesn't take a whole lot to be able to use this technology. If you don't really care about it being done well and being done safely, all you need to do is access a fertility clinic and then basically inject. It's no more complicated than injecting the CRISPR technology into the embryos, and editing will happen. Now, if you don't care if it's done well, then that's all there is to it. Now, if you want to make sure that it's done well and is done safely, that's actually very challenging, and we're not anywhere near the point in 2019 where we've established the safety, and it might be years, if ever, that'll be shown to be safe.
Well, and not to put too crude a label on all of this, but of course, money is always a consideration when you have people wanting to have designer babies. As with any other field, money comes into play. How expensive is CRISPR to use? I mean, is this something that people conceivably could go to a fertility clinic and pay out thousands of dollars and say, mess with my embryo, I want a really great athlete?
Yeah, so I don't know about making a great athlete. I don't know that we know enough now and which genes we would have to change, and it would probably have to be hundreds of genes that you have to change to really increase something like athletic ability or intelligence. So there's that technical challenge. But you raise a good point. It actually would not be that expensive above and beyond what it already costs to do in vitro fertilization and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and screening to ensure that the embryo is exactly what you want it to be before you establish a pregnancy. The components of the CRISPR system are actually relatively inexpensive. Injecting them uses equipment that's already in the fertility clinic, already used. So that doesn't actually add much cost in terms of doing the procedure. Now, ensuring that it's safe, that adds some costs. But frankly, compared to the procedure itself as it already exists, it's not adding much in the way of cost. Now, that's not going to prevent a fertility clinic that's doing this to make money. It's not going to prevent them from jacking up the price as high as they want if there are parents desperate enough to feel that they need to use this.
Sure.
So that's really concerning.
Yeah, it is. Well, and the upside of CRISPR, I know one of the things that you mentioned is the potential, as you're a cardiologist, is the potential for, heart attack treatment, that you could potentially prevent heart attacks. And that's a huge killer. So that would be a massive breakthrough if we could get to that point.
Yeah, heart disease is the number one killer of men, of women in the United States, even in the poorest countries on Earth. It is the global health threat of the 21st century. And what I've been working on in my laboratory is using CRISPR to be able to turn off cholesterol genes in the liver in adult patients who have heart disease or who are at risk of getting heart disease. And the idea is with a single shot, you can permanently reduce someone's cholesterol levels. It'd be like taking a pill every day for the rest of your life, but with a single shot, once and done.
Wow.
And it would protect you from heart disease for the rest of your life.
Okay. That would be incredible. Well, we're out of time, but Dr. Karen Musunuru, the name of the book is The CRISPR Generation. Doctor, so good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here, and we'll be right back. This archived broadcast of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by TriStar Pictures' A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, based on the true story, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks and Matthew Rhys. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters now. We are back on Janet Mefford today. According to CNBC, Obamacare signups on the federal health insurance marketplace fell 20% in the first 2 weeks of the 2020 enrollment season compared with last year. This is according to new federal data that was just released. And as they report, the tally comes as a federal appeals court in New Orleans is expected to issue a decision any day now on a lower court ruling that overturned Obamacare in that case of Texas versus the United States. What effect will all this have on the growing alternative to Obamacare and private health insurance? And I'm talking about health care sharing ministries like Liberty HealthShare, a national nonprofit health care sharing ministry. We're going to get some thoughts now from its chief communications officer, Matt Bellis. Matt, so good to have you with us again.
Thank you for having me, Janet.
This is interesting. Obamacare just continues to wind its way through the courts. Now we have this decision that can come down at any time regarding whether or not Obamacare is unconstitutional. I mean, from your vantage point with a healthcare sharing ministry, how does this affect you and how does this affect what you're doing with the people who are part of Liberty HealthShare?
Well, the good news is that healthcare sharing is not in any way considered health insurance.
Right.
And so for any kind of direct effect because of the nation's largest health insurance law of the land, it doesn't affect us in that regard. However, it does affect us in terms of people looking for different ways to take care of their health care because they see this as what it is, a strange turn of events that people start to think, what are the different ways of how I can take care of my health care outside of this third-party payment program?
Right.
And so our inquiries have actually risen over this past month. We see it as a regular seasonal uptick in traffic. But we have seen the fact that people are interested in finding new ways of taking care of their health care. And when I say new to them, because this is, frankly, a system that's been around for ages and ages. So as it affects third-party payment, I can see that. But with health care sharing, we're on a growing trend.
Yes. Well, you certainly have been. That's been one of the big stories. And I know a lot of outlets have been reporting on this, the fact that, you know, outlets like yours, Liberty HealthShare and nonprofit ministry, you have had so much response from people. I know lots and lots of people listening are really responding because they're saying, listen, this whole health insurance thing is, you know, I'm going broke from all this. These premiums keep going up and up and up. I mean, how have you seen the difference at Liberty HealthShare when you're talking to people who say, boy, I'm just paying so much money for health insurance. Somebody help me here.
It's interesting that you say that because I was just in Washington, D.C. this week talking to some friends of ours saying that before they joined Liberty, they were paying up towards $4,000 a month in their medical bills for their premiums, and almost $16,000 with a deductible.
Wow.
And he said that's just unimaginable. It was our largest business expense, and we had to find something else. And whenever he said, you know, I was able to keep my doctor, I was able to get the same type of service, and only pay $529 for my family, he said it was an absolute no-brainer. Plus, he knows that the share amounts that he sends in to Liberty HealthShare, they're not going to Liberty HealthShare for, you know, executive balloon or executive parachutes. It's going towards other people who have a need.
Right.
He wants to be a part of the community, be a support and help to other people. He wants to live by his conscience and bear the burdens of others, give to one another, all the while benefiting from the right standards that we've put in place and having lower cost health care. So he said it was just an absolutely no-brainer for it, he and his family. And that's a story we hear all over the place.
Oh, I'm sure. What is it like for somebody who's listening who says, well, I have health insurance. I'm sick of the third-party payer system. I'm sick of my premium levels. I don't want to continue to pay so much for my health insurance. I like the idea of my bills going down a lot, which is what happens when you make the switch. But how easy is it to make the switch? What is the process? And what is involved in switching from health insurance to Liberty Health Share?
Well, it's important if you are an individual and you've got a third-party payment plan, take a look and see when that expires or sunsets or changes. And if you want to join Liberty HealthShare, you can join. Because, frankly, with Liberty HealthShare, we're not tied to the open enrollment season. So if you miss your deadline in December or even January, we're still here for you. You can join at any time. It's a very simple, easy process. Just go online, spend a few minutes to fill out the application, and we'll be back in touch with you between 24 to 72 hours. Very simple process. We want to be here for people whenever they're ready and make sure that this is a good fit for them.
Well, that's good. And I know people can go to libertyhealthshare.org and check out all the questions and answers that you've got there. You've got so much information. Basically, when you're talking about the switch, Matt, people do have basic questions that tend toward how much deductibles will cost, what copays are. What is the basic information on those two subjects, deductibles and copays?
Well, being a healthcare sharing ministry, we're not deducting costs from what you receive. We don't have co-pays when you go to the doctor. We have share amounts, and we have what we call annual unshared amounts. Share amounts are a monthly basis, that something that you pay. Your share amount goes directly to another person in need. $299 for an individual, $399 for a couple, $529 for a family of three or more for our most comprehensive program, Liberty Complete. And then whenever you have a medical bill, a condition, you have your, what is called your annual unshared amount. It's $1,000 for an individual, $1,750 for a couple, and $2,250 for, again, that family of three or more.
Good to know. That's good to know. What about health screenings prior to coming on board with Liberty Health Share? Do you have things like certain pre-existing conditions are not allowed? What are the parameters on those things?
We don't have a lab or a physical that you have to go through to join Liberty Health Share. You have a medical history questionnaire that you fill out, and based on that medical history questionnaire, may have some more questions. You may even think you have a pre-existing condition, and considered by our guidelines, you may not have a pre-existing condition. Or even if you have a pre-existing condition that is a result of a lifestyle issue, even like type 2 diabetes or obesity, smoking, heart disease, we can sign you up for a program called Health Track, which is an extra $80 per month charge. But with that, you get a health coach that works with you to achieve some self-set, predetermined goals. And whenever you reach those goals, you graduate from Health Track and you retain your Liberty Health Share membership. It's one of those ways to really turn around your life. We've seen a lot of good, positive outcomes from our program of Health Track. But Liberty Health Share, whenever you come to join us, we want you to know that we're here for your best benefit now. And we want to make sure that we can work together. So if you want to find out what it'd be like to join Liberty Health Share, just go through the application process. It's free, doesn't cost a thing, and find out if Liberty Health Share is a good fit for you.
Well, very good. The other question I know that comes up from various people who are inquiring about Liberty Health Share is, will my bills be paid? How do I know that my bills will be paid? And that's kind of a bottom line question, isn't it?
It really is, and that's the essence of what we want to do. With Liberty Health Share, our whole goal is to make sure that our members are getting their medical bills paid. This is a voluntary program. It doesn't work if Liberty Health Share and its members don't share in medical costs with one another. And it's not Liberty Health Share paying your medical bills, it's the membership of people sharing in those medical bills.
Right.
So those laws of give and take and being a part of a community have shown a huge success rate in getting medical bills taken care of. We really appreciate what our members have done. If you want to be a part of Liberty Health Share, you can just find out how successful our systems are.
Very good. Well, check out libertyhealthshare.org. Matt Bellis with us from Liberty Health Share, a national nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry. Matt, always good to chat with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. God bless. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today.
From
TriStar Pictures comes A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, based on the true story of the real-life friendship between Fred Rogers and a cynical journalist, showing that kindness can triumph.
You love broken people like me.
Sometimes we have to ask for help, and that's okay.
A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks and Matthew Reese. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. In theaters now. More information is available online at resources.abeautifulday.movie.
If you're looking for adventure, serving as a volunteer on the Mercy Ship is an adventure like no other. And you'll be serving on the largest non-governmental hospital ship in the world, providing free care to some of the world's poorest people. Whether it's performing a surgery, cleaning the deck, or transporting a patient to a recovery center, every day you'll be making a difference in the lives of struggling people. Begin your adventure today. Connect with us at mercyships.org. It's an adventure of a lifetime.
Every day, babies in their mothers' wombs are fighting for life, with abortion being the leading cause of death.
I already had my mind made up. I was like, I'm going to go through with it.
The Ministry of Preborn has pregnancy centers nationwide, standing by to help young moms in crisis choose life. Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasound sessions in the country. By letting a mother see her baby in the womb and hear the baby's heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to choose life for her baby.
When I'm sitting there, the lady is giving me my ultrasound. She's like making these weird faces. She's like, it's two. I just start crying. I can't.
And sometimes the blessing is doubled. Would you join with Preborn and Janet Mefford today to help save 400 babies by the end of the year? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies from abortion. And now through a match, your gift will be doubled. To donate, dial 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by TriStar Pictures, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, based on the true story. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks and Matthew Reese, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters now. Well, you might have noticed that too much of the content on TV is violent or full of profanity or based on inappropriate themes, especially for kids. That's why it's so important to know not only who's sponsoring the bad TV content, but to know which companies are sponsoring good TV content, especially as we're all thinking about where our dollars should go during the Christmas shopping season. And the Parents Television Council is now out with a very important list for every mom and dad to consult, the best and worst TV advertisers for 2019. So we're going to check in now with Tim Winter, president of the Parents Television Council. Always great to have you here, Tim. How are you doing?
Hello, Janet. Just hearing your voice on the phone makes me smile, and good day to you and your listeners from Los Angeles.
Oh, great to have you. It's nice that you make me smile too, Tim. Every time I listen to you, it makes me smile because you're giving us the information we need to know when we're turning on the TV and we're not always aware of what we're going to be finding on TV in front of our kids. This is great information, though, for parents to have on hand. As you say, these advertisers really are the lifeblood of TV programs, and what they sponsor really matters. How important do you think it is for parents to know who is sponsoring the TV shows their kids are watching? How critical is this?
It is. I don't know if there's anything more critical. I would say the only thing more critical than knowing who's sponsoring the shows is to make sure that parents are aware of the toxicity of so many of these television shows. But the toxicity is made possible only through the ad spends, the media dollars of the major corporate advertisers. And that's why it's so, you know, we're going to the money here. Follow the money to where the source is of some of this problematic content. It starts with the advertisers.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with the bad news first so we can finish with the good news. But when we're talking about some of the worst, who do we need to know about?
Well, if you're going to be going to one of the large retail stores, you know, our favorite retail stores, I don't think it would come as a surprise to most of your listeners that Target is on the bad list.
Yeah.
And Walmart is on the good list. And, you know, there's, I think we all at some point in our lives need to go into a Walmart, and they certainly seem to have the most robust media buying plans of any of the major retail outlets out there.
Well, that's good. What is Target sponsoring that makes their sponsorship so problematic?
They appeared on a number of our most problematic shows this last year. I Feel Bad, which was a show on NBC that had a woman who was very self-sexualizing and a lot of really inappropriate content, not just for children, but delivered by children in the shows. They also sponsored a couple of other shows that were really on our radar, Videos After Dark, which was kind of an almost like an R-rated America's Funniest Home Videos. It was at a pilot stage, and the good news is we don't think it's going to be made into a series because we talked to the advertisers, and I think they heard us.
That's great. Well, yeah, it wouldn't be surprising to listeners to hear that Target is doing that because they're all about being edgy, right? So for some of these companies that are on the bad list, do you think that really is what is driving this? They want to be able to be as edgy as possible?
It's twofold. That is certainly number one. They want to reach out to a young audience. They think that in order to do that, they have to be edgy. That's certainly one very key concern that that we've found. The other one, and routinely this comes as a surprise to us, it's just plain ignorance. They hand over their media dollars to their media buying agency. Their agency, often, you know, Madison Avenue, New York City, they look to see what is the audience we're trying to reach, and they try to line up the show that might reach that target without even thinking about, is this content appropriate for my brand image? The corporation thinks about that, but their media buyer, the ad agency, often does not. And they're the ones who are actually making the buying and the selling.
Well, that's really interesting. So have you found it to be the case in the past that when you have gone to some of these companies that have sponsored bad advertisers, that bad shows, I should say, that in fact they didn't even know that they were sponsoring the bad shows? Is that a pretty common thing?
It is, indeed. And that's why, you know, sometimes we will get our members to speak up and speak out to sponsors. Sometimes we'll actually buy shares in a stock and go to the shareholder meeting and stand up in front of the shareholders and say to the CEO, eyeball to eyeball, this is what you're doing. And they have gatekeepers along the way who prevent our messages from reaching the CEO. But along the way, somebody still has to be held accountable. And that's why this list is so important. That's why public awareness is so important. If members of the public see this list of the bad advertisers, walk in and communicate to a store manager along the way, this is fed back up the food chain, and ultimately they will make a better decision.
That's really, really good. Also, when I'm looking at this list of some of these bad advertisers, the department stores on your list include Kohl's and Victoria's Secret. Now, Kohl's, I know, kind of has a family image in a way. I mean, I know a lot of us parents, a lot of us moms are always shopping at Kohl's. Seems like a pretty family-friendly store. What are they doing?
Similar to Target. They and again, we've tried to communicate with them. it's a matter of just getting their attention.
Yeah.
And we've tried and tried with Kohl's, and we've gotten, I think, a couple of dismissive emails and letters back saying, oh, your letter's very important to us. Thank you very much. And that's it. But no action, no change, no improvement. And unless and until we see an improvement, we will keep them on the worst list. We will hold them publicly to account, and we will urge our members to use their dollars, you know, for good, for good advertisers.
Would you say the most effective way to communicate your disapproval of what these stores are sponsoring is to talk to your local store manager? Because I'm sure, like a lot of people, hearing you say, well, if the Parents Television Council can't even get to them, how in the world is my complaint going to be heard?
That's exactly right. We have heard wonderful stories of success where the Parents Television Council, you know, I'm sitting here in my office in Los Angeles, and I can try to get the attention of the corporate executives. But what the corporate executives, they don't want to hear from me. They don't like what I have to say.
Right, right.
And they don't want to hear from me. But what they do listen to is the corporate executives listen to their store managers and the retail outlets where customers come in and complain. They listen there. They'll monitor their social media. And if parents, people who are listening to this this conversation right now, go on, you know, for instance, on the Kohl's social media website and say, hey, I sure would like to spend my money here for Christmas, but unless and until you make better media buys, until you start using your dollars that are more reflective of my values, then I'm not going to do that. That's the type of thing that will get the corporate executives' attention. Boots on the ground.
Absolutely. Can you tell people in part what is Kohl's sponsoring so people have that information at hand if they happen to go to Kohl's and complain or go on Twitter or Facebook to complain?
If I can get back to you on that one, and maybe we could post that on social media and we can get the word out. We'll
Great.
Give you a couple of specifics. I don't have that at the ready.
Yeah, no problem. But people can go to parentstv.org also and get more information. What about the best advertisers, Tim? We want to have a little good news here. Who are some of the best companies in terms of sponsoring TV content?
We are very happy to welcome back to the best list Wendy's restaurants. For years, when the spirit of Dave Thomas lived on, and they were very family friendly, they took a turn. They tried to reach out to a younger audience. They got edgy. They sponsored some bad stuff. They were off our good list for a long time. Now they're back on, and we're very happy to see them back on the list. Our friends at the Smucker Corporation are always leading the way. Coca-Cola also. AT&T for a while had been on our good list, but now AT&T, which owns HBO and is airing a very disturbing, troubling, teen-targeted show called Euphoria. I think we've even talked about Euphoria.
Yes, we have.
And they also own DirecTV with the pornographic channels on DirecTV. So, AT&T, we felt, even though they were moderate in their advertising principles, as a matter of corporate policy, they have taken such a sharp turn towards really harmful content, especially for teens and children, that they did not make the list this year. Verizon's back on the list after being off for a couple of years. Procter & Gamble, always the bellwether. The Tide, Pampers, Crest toothpaste, Charmin toilet paper. I know those aren't types of things you want to go out and put under the Christmas tree, but those are something that we buy every day, every week, every month. And those are that Procter & Gamble really deserves, a big boost, a big shining light on their good behavior and the support of your listeners and our members.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I noticed also Dairy Queen was on your list, and that was good. That was another restaurant that was on that list.
That might explain my weight gain over the last year as well.
Too many blizzards, right?
Exactly.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a really good list. I'm really glad that you guys do this. It's a great help to parents across the country so you can figure out who you should support as we go into the Christmas season. You can find out more at parentstv.org. Tim Winter, as always, a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for weighing in and informing us all.
Thank you, Janet.
All right. God bless you. Thanks for being with us. Would you please help us help preborn save 400 babies by the end of the year? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies from abortion. And now through a matching gift, your gift will be doubled. All you need to do is call 855-402-BABY, 855-402-2229, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next time.